Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. A major set of leaked documents revealing China's oppression of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities has been published by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a global network of more than 220 journalists in 80 countries who collaborate on in-depth investigative stories. Joining us to talk about what these documents reveal are two guests. Sheila Alechi is an investigative reporter and video journalist for the ICIJ. She heads their Asia desk, where she coordinates the investigative work of the consortium's partners and members in Asia. In 2016, Sheila Alechi was a member of the Japanese reporting team that took part in the Pulitzer Prize-winning Panama Papers investigation. Hi, Sheila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you.
And Sasha Chevkin is a reporter with ICIJ and lead reporter on several investigations, including the Evicted and Abandoned investigation. It revealed massive forced displacement caused by projects funded by the World Bank. Hi, Sasha. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
It's great to have both of you. Thank you so much. So first of all, let's talk about how you all obtained this unprecedented cache of documents about the oppression of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in China. Sheila, how did the ICIJ obtain these documents?
The documents came to ICIJ via a chain of exiled Uyghurs. And after the ICIJ obtained these documents, we made sure that we could verify the authenticity. So we spoke to different experts, not only in the U.S., but in other countries. And considering the fact that this is not a one-country problem, we decided to involve our media partners around the world and started this collaboration with 17 media partners and more than 75 journalists who not only spoke to other experts, again, to verify the authenticity of the documents, but also spoke to more than 40 Uyghurs in exile to understand whether the content of the document matched their experience.
And reading from just one of the many pieces that you all wrote, these documents have been verified by linguists and experts, including James Mulvenin, Director of Intelligence Integration at SOS International. It's an intelligence and information technology contractor. This person is an expert in authentication of classified Chinese government documents, and they called the Chinese language documents very authentic, adding that they adhere 100% to all of the classified document templates that I've ever seen. Sasha, do you want to add anything about the authentication of these documents and how you got them?
I think Sheila has covered it pretty well. The only thing that I would add is that we also compared them with the reports that have been published to date and by the stories of people who had actually been through the camps. So not only Uyghur exiles whose family members had gone through, but people who had been through the experience themselves.
Before we dive in and talk about what you all learned, let's talk about Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities that live in the region. Is it Xinjiang province? Sheila, I just want to make sure I'm saying that right.
Yeah, okay. Xinjiang.
So what can you tell us? First off, let's talk about the Uyghurs, because this cache of documents got so much media attention. Just tell us a little bit about the Uyghurs before we dive in.
Right. So the Uyghurs are an ethnic minority group who lives in Xinjiang. Xinjiang is a province in the northwest of China. It's a Turkic ethnic group, and most of them are Muslim. So they have a distinct culture and history compared to the majority of Chinese, who are Han, of Han. The tensions between Beijing and Xinjiang residents also stem from this different cultural and religious background.
And what would you add, Sasha? Again, according to one of your reports, the Uyghurs have lived in this region for more than 1,000 years. They have long faced economic marginalization and political discrimination. As an ethnic minority, they account for about 11 million people, where 92% of the 1.4 billion population is of Han Chinese ethnicity.
That's correct. There also have been two short-lived independent republics that were each called East Turkestan, that were created as a Uyghur homeland in, I believe, 1933 and 1945. And I think that speaks to the aspiration that some people have for their own identity. And China, of course, is very fiercely opposed to any kind of separatism. And a lot of the ferocity of the Chinese response is connected to this effort to impose strict Chinese control within Xinjiang.
There have been many stories about how the Chinese government is targeting Muslims, but is this about religion or is it more complex? Because you all report that in recent years, Chinese President Xi Jinping has stepped up a nationwide campaign promoting conformity to Communist Party doctrine and Han cultural norms. So what is really the reasoning behind all of this?
So, religion is also, it's mentioned in some of the white papers that the Chinese government has released also in relation to the camps as a factor in terms of the government's attempt to eradicate terrorism and extreme and fanaticism. So that's surely one of the terms that they include in their policy and programs. But it is, as you said, more complex than that. It's not just about religion.
What would you add, Sasha?
I think, as you say, it's multifactorial. There's elements of religion, of ethnicity, and of a response to violent incidents that have taken place in the past. But I do think there's substantial evidence that the underlying drive is to impose this nationalism based on Han identity and membership in the Chinese Communist Party. And anything that is seen as a rival to that, whether it be being a Muslim, whether it's being a Uyghur, all of those are things that the Chinese government is trying to stamp out.
And in addition to the Uyghurs, there are other Central Asian people living in this area, Kazakhs, Uzbeks, Tajiks. So can you talk about some of the other ethnic minorities in the group and what people need to know about them, Sheila?
I'm not sure I am the expert on that. What we see in the documents, we don't see ethnicity mentions of it. We see that they mention ethnicities, and they use several ways to identify whether people, residents and people living in Xinjiang, what kind of ethnicity or group they belong to. So it's surely something that we know from the documents that the Chinese government is taking into consideration and controlling and monitoring very closely.
And there's a larger pattern of the Chinese government cracking down on ethnic minorities and religious minorities. We see that in Tibet, which is also an ethnically different and religiously different, primarily Buddhist area, and among other Muslim minorities within China. So, again, I think there's a consistent theme here of trying to promote a single Chinese identity and cracking down on alternatives to that.
As you said, more than 75 journalists from ICIJ and 17 media partner organizations in 14 countries joined together to report on the documents and their significance. What really stood out for you in these documents, Sheila?
Well, several things. First, I think it was since it's maybe the first time that we see that we were able to kind of understand how the extent of the government's control and plans to control a minority in their own words. So I was one of the things that struck me was the details that they had and the words that they were using in the documents in describing the logistics and how they were running this camp. But also another thing was when I talked to Uyghurs, I was struck by the fact that their experience actually matched what we were seeing. So it's not just a set of documents and dry papers that we obtained. It's about people's lives and how they were treating people really in those camps.
I want to read one quote from a Uyghur since you brought up what they told you and the fact that it matched what you read in the documents. In one of the pieces, it says, by 2017, moving to curtail expressions of cultural, political, and religious diversity, President Xi ordered a quiet campaign of mass detention and forced assimilation in Xinjiang. Large numbers of people across the region began to disappear, according to witnesses and news reports, and rumors of secretive detention camps swirled. In some villages in the south, police had been ordered to sweep up nearly 40% of the adult population. And Tursune Ziavdan, a 40-year-old Uyghur woman who is now in Kazakhstan and spent 11 months in a camp in Xinjiang, she said, at that time, it was terror among people. When we saw each other, people were terrified. The only thing we were talking about was saying, ah, you're still here. In all the families, there was someone arrested, some the entire family. And you can read the entire story at yourcallradio.org. I just wanted to read that since Sheila brought up the voices of the Uyghurs. Sasha, what really stood out for you when you read these documents?
I guess to me is just this stunning totalitarian vision that comes through. I mean, the level of control that is imposed in these camps where, not only are the doors double locked, but prisoners' activities down to their bathroom breaks are monitored. They're given scores that are put into a government database, and those scores are then used to determine when they're allowed to be released from the camp. People are swept up using a predictive policing app in which people will be candidates for detention simply because they used a certain mobile app or because they traveled abroad from Xinjiang and came back. And I guess it's this vision of complete government control, also aided by very sophisticated technology. It's sort of Big Brother in the 21st century.
That's what struck me also. According to Human Rights Watch, the sources include Xinjiang's countless checkpoints, closed circuit cameras with facial recognition, spyware that the police require Uyghurs to install in their phones, Wi-Fi sniffers that collect identifying information of smartphones and computers. Police and other authorities use a mobile app to run background checks and communicate with the integrated joint operations platform in real time, and they collect vast amounts of personal information on citizens. So how do the police, basically, how do they force Uyghurs to install this spyware on their phones? Did you learn more about that, Sasha?
Well, what I can talk about is the materials that are revealed within these documents. And what they show is how an app sent, what the literal Chinese translation, I'm told, is push notifications for essentially indicating if a person belongs to a certain group, their names would be pushed out through this app. But we see in some of the documents we obtained orders for, I believe, something like 24,000 people to be candidates for detention, of which more than 15,000 were then detained simply because of what essentially was a formula of artificial intelligence. Shilla also reported in detail about how a certain mobile app was a criteria for people being placed under suspicion.
Right, so this is different from the spyware that you were mentioning before. This is an app called Zapia in English and Kuaiya in Chinese that people would just use to share files, videos, and photos among each other, just the same way you would have an AirDrop in your Mac, or it's just a normal app that you can download. The problem was that it became very famous and popular among the Muslim community after 2012 as a way to share messages and other content about Islam as well. And so after the authorities understood that, it automatically became a red flag. So whoever had this app in their phone could be a suspect, because they could use it to share religious content. And so according to the documents that we have obtained, at least in 2017, at least more than 1.8 million Uyghurs were using this app. And because of that, the authorities were able to see whether these people were imams, what kind of ethnicity they were. And the documents also instructed officials to for those who had this app installed in their phones to have further checks, and whether and if they couldn't rule out any suspicion, then the person had to be arrested and sent to a camp.
That is Shilla Alechi, an investigative reporter and a video journalist for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. It's a global network of more than 220 journalists in 80 countries who do really incredible work on in-depth investigative stories. Shilla heads their Asia desk, where she coordinates the investigative work of ICIJ's partners and members in Asia. Sasha Chevkin is a reporter for ICIJ and a lead reporter on several investigations and a major set of leaked documents revealing China's oppression of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities has been published by the ICIJ. 17 media partners and 75 journalists worked on this, and it's gotten just extensive coverage over the past couple of weeks. If you have any questions about what they found and the fallout, how the government is responding to this in China and other governments around the globe, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or send us a tweet at yourcallradio. So, Shilla, since you brought up the camps, let's talk about this, because the Chinese government has tried to keep the camps a secret. And according to your piece Exposed, in late 2017, journalists, academics, and other researchers using satellite images, government procurement documents, and eyewitness accounts revealed a string of detention facilities surrounded by fences and guard towers across the region and the outlines of a new and alarming system of mass surveillance. So tell us what these satellite images revealed.
So, since at least 2018, a lot of researchers have tried to understand the scale of the problem and to see really where these people were being sent to. Just by using, some of them used procurement data that was publicly available to see whether municipalities or the region were buying or material or ordering equipment for large camps or large buildings. What they did was cross-check that information with satellite images to identify not only the type of building that was being built, but whether there were fences or watchtowers, etc., that could indicate that the building was not a school, but something more similar to effectively what looks like a prison. And so far, Obviously, it's very difficult to know the number of these camps. There are some Australian researchers who think there may be between 200 and more than 1,000 camps. And recently, just a few weeks ago, a Washington, D.C.-based group released a detailed map saying that there are at least 500 of this in Xinjiang.
And Sasha, you also report that an unknown number of detainees have died in the camps due to poor living conditions and lack of medical treatment, and this is according to eyewitness accounts.
Yes, there have been reports of deaths that have occurred in the camp. There have also been reports of very serious human rights abuses, including sexual abuse and torture that have taken place in these camps. What's interesting is that the operations manual for the camps that we obtained, while on the one hand it described this Orwellian level of control, also included a number of measures for protecting the health, even the food safety of the food served in the camps, earthquake prevention. It included instructions that no one was supposed to die within the camp. So I think what the document showed is that on the one hand, there was some level of kind of a paternalistic vision for these camps, that they were supposed to be keeping people safe even as they were eradicating their culture and uprooting them from their homes. On the other hand, there's a substantial amount of evidence that that hasn't always been the case, and that there have been people who have been tortured, sexually abused, and even have died within the camp. Mm.
That is Sasha Chevkin. Sasha and Sheila Alechi are investigative reporters with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's go to Bradley in San Francisco. Hi, Bradley. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Rose. Hi. I just wanted to know, in the words of the state in their documents, do they have any recognition that mistakes might be made? I mean, I know the whole thing is a mistake, but the task of eradicating the culture is outrageous. But, you know, in their minds, is there any process for, if someone's falsely dealt with, for redress or recognition or correction? Is any of that in any of the documents, or is it just like they're infallible and that, you know, people are subject to whatever comes?
Yeah, thank you, Bradley. Sheila, can you answer that question?
Yeah, so first of all, I just wanted to mention that our website, if you go to our website, you can read the documents. We have also an English translation, so if you want to know about the details, I would recommend to do that. And then the other thing is that they don't say, what they talk about is that the fact that guards and everyone has to keep strict secrecy about the camps. So, and that there has to be training also on the guards on how to basically, they have to keep being always vigilant about what's going on inside. So we don't see any element, at least from these documents. There may be others that we don't know about, but from these documents, we don't see any element about them talking about mistakes or, yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Sasha.
And I just add that one very striking element of the whole system described in the documents is that people are essentially guilty until proven innocent. There is no court or judicial process for that someone has to go through in order to be held in these internment camps. Instead, you are literally put through a policing app based on your identity, and then people who fit within those identities are candidates for detention, and if suspicion cannot be ruled out, then vast numbers of those people end up being detained.
I want to ask you two more questions before we go to break and say goodbye, because this is really important. Sasha, you have a piece about Xinjiang's architect of mass detention. Is it Zhu Hailun?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so you report that the confidential government documents that show China's plans for sweeping extrajudicial detentions and internment camps in Xinjiang are all signed by one man, and that is Zhu Heilun. So tell us about this man.
So Zhu Heilun, at the time he signs these documents, is the second most powerful official in Xinjiang. He's the deputy chief of the region's Communist Party, and he's also the top security officer for Xinjiang. And what's interesting about his career is that he actually was born in a completely different part of China on a prosperous eastern province called Jiangsu. And he was sent to Xinjiang when he was only 7 years old as part of a program called the Sent Down Youth, or the Educated Youth, where as a part of the Cultural Revolution under Mao, educated young people from prosperous areas were sent to rural parts of the country in order to advance the Communist Revolution. And Zhu, instead of going home like many sent down youth, actually stays in Xinjiang and spends his whole career working in some of the toughest and the most volatile parts of the region. And so basically, after he himself was uprooted at 17 years old through this government program, he became one of the government's top enforcers and top experts working within Uyghur majority areas of Xinjiang itself. And when China really readies this crackdown that began in 2017 and brings in as the top official in Xinjiang someone named Chen Kuangguo, who is had just imposed a strong crackdown in Tibet before he came there, and is really sort of one of their top experts on imposing order on ethnic minorities. Zhu Heilun is the Xinjiang expert who has worked there for decades, who gets brought in as his number two to carry out this program.
And Zhu did not respond to questions sent to him via China's international press contact point. Responding to questions about the camps and the surveillance program from your partner, The Guardian, the Chinese government called these documents, quote, pure fabrication and fake news. Sheila, final thoughts on what the outcome has been from this massive cache of leaked documents?
Well, I think, the fact that we are here talking about it, it's a positive factor. It means that more people know about it, hopefully. The other thing is that since we have collaborated with partners in 14 different countries, we have also asked for comments to the local, our 14 country governments. And so some of them have some of the officials, including the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, have called for on China to release the detainees, or at least to let UN investigators in Xinjiang. So I think one of the outcomes is raising awareness on the issue, but also really pressuring our government to do something about it.
Well, we will definitely do a follow-up to this story maybe next month to find out what happened, how governments are responding. And we don't have time, but I would also really like to talk about what happens when people leave these camps. Sheila Alechi is an investigative reporter and video journalist for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Sasha Chevkin is a reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and they got their hands on a major set of leaked documents revealing China's oppression of Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. Sheila and Sasha, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. You can find their reporting and the cache of documents, if you'd like to really dig in, at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will be joined by Brian Goldstone. He wrote a really incredible piece for the California Sunday Magazine called Three Kids, Two Paychecks, No Home. And it is about how the housing crisis in California has forced families to live in their cars in Salinas, California. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of California's housing crisis. This is receiving national attention. There is a very important new piece out in the California Sunday Magazine about how working families in Salinas, California, are being forced to live in their cars. 3,566 elementary students there are homeless. That is 40% of the total student population. And you can read the piece. It's called Three Kids, Two Paychecks, No Home, and it's by Brian Goldstone. Brian is a writer, cultural anthropologist, and director of In the Press, a new journalism and public humanities initiative at Duke University's Franklin Humanities Institute. Brian Goldstone is currently working on a book about the growing crisis of housing insecurity and homelessness in many, many cities across the country, and it's called The New American Homeless. Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for writing this important piece. Like I said, it's about families in Salinas, California, which is a couple of hours south of San Francisco, who do not have homes and they're being forced to live in their cars. You lead the story off with a family of five who were living out of their Toyota Sienna in various fields and parking lots. First off, what took you to Salinas, California?
Well, I was actually interested in writing about the role of schools in kind of providing a support system for homeless families. And this is based on a previous article I had written about family homelessness, actually based in Atlanta, Georgia. And in my sort of looking around at different what different school districts were doing to support their students and their families, I came across a school district in Monterey County, the Salinas City Elementary School District, and I saw that this staggering statistic that nearly half of the students in the elementary school district were experiencing homelessness. And so that's what originally took me out to that part of the country.
And this is so important because so many schools across the country now they have like homelessness liaisons, right? So they're working with the families to try to find them shelter. In some cases in San Francisco, some kids were being sheltered in the gym of the school. So can you just talk about this quickly, since you've done so much work on school homelessness?
Yeah, so I was actually surprised to learn that every school district in the country is legally required to have what's called a homeless liaison. And this is someone in the school. It could be a teacher. Usually it's a teacher working sort of part-time in this position, and maybe they teach a class or PE or something on the side. But it's someone who is basically tasked with ensuring that students in the school who are experiencing housing instability don't fall through the cracks and, you know, end up having to leave the school or drop out. So, you know, according to the federal law, they are required to, for instance, make sure that if a student's family has to live like 45 minutes away from the school, that a bus will be sent to pick them up, even at like a motel that the family is staying in. So there's this kind of minimal requirement that every homeless liaison is supposed to be doing. In this particular school district, partly because of the sheer, you know, scale of the crisis here of family homelessness, the district has set up what they call the Family Resource Center, and they are just going way above and beyond what this legal requirement is, and they're really providing what they call like a wraparound system of care for these families, and it's really extraordinary.
And when you look at student homelessness across the country, what really stands out for you? Are the numbers growing, and can we really trust the official numbers? Is there any real way to know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the really striking things that I discovered in doing this reporting was that the official number, or, you know, that sort of is part of the even the media narrative, it makes its way into the headlines around these issues, that, like, when it comes to family homelessness, we're seeing a decline. That's kind of the official line right now. But that narrative is based on the point in time count, which is the annual homeless census that takes place in January every year. It's mandated by HUD. And so just to give you a sense of the sort of disparity in numbers, so according to HUD, there were, let's see, I have the number right here, there were 21,272 homeless families in California. This was in the last count. Now, that seems like a really, you know, big number, but the schools who do their own count, they counted 262,935 homeless students. That's just the students. That's not even their family members, and that's not families who are outside of the school system. So that's a difference of 241,000 students just in California. And in my research, I found that that is replicated in every state in the country. You get an exponentially larger number when it's the schools counting these families and not HUD in their homeless census that takes place every year.
Brian, what are your thoughts on how the media are covering this crisis? I mean, big papers like the New York Times luckily have the resources to do investigative reports on this. The Times actually just today has a piece out. 114,000 New York students are homeless. Meet two of them. But what are your thoughts overall about coverage?
Yeah, that was a really amazing piece, and I was so happy to see that. By and large, however, I'll say that I think the media can be doing a better job of sort of going beyond, again, that kind of official version of the homelessness crisis, if it's even called a crisis, that we receive from the federal government and even from local governments. For obvious reasons, you know, political leaders have a vested interest in sort of portraying housing stability or instability and homelessness in a particular way. And when the magnitude of the situation is downplayed, as it almost invariably is, in these official reports, I believe it's, you know, up to us as journalists to kind of go beyond that. And in this case, you know, you have this vast population of people, in particular families, who are just really being rendered invisible by these numbers, and they're literally not being counted, and therefore they're being locked out of really vital housing assistance. And you just don't really see that being reported in the press, unfortunately.
Brian Goldstone is a writer and director of In the Press, a new journalism and public humanities initiative at Duke University's Franklin Humanities Institute. And he wrote a very important piece for the California Sunday Magazine, South of San Francisco in a fertile corner of California that feeds much of the country. Working families are sleeping in shelters and parking lots. So, Brian, let's talk a little bit about Salinas Valley for people who aren't that familiar with it. As you report, Salinas produces roughly two-thirds of the United States lettuce and much of our celery, cauliflower, wine grapes, broccoli, and strawberries. It's an $8 billion agricultural economy driven by corporate giants. These are very well-known names. Dole, for example, Taylor Farms, Driscoll's. These companies made the valley a place of immense wealth. As you report more recently, there's been an influx of people working in Silicon Valley coming down for housing there. So tell us more about that. You know, people in Silicon Valley, where that's booming, they're having a hard time finding housing in the area, like Palo Alto, for example.
What I think is so fascinating about this situation, or disturbing, I should say, is that, you know, Salinas and the Salinas Valley has always been a kind of a working class area, an agricultural hub, as you mentioned. It's never been kind of a wealthy city. But the reason we're seeing this really, really drastic spike in homelessness over the last several years is because the housing epidemic in the Bay Area is kind of radiating outward into this, you know, previous enclave of affordability. And so people whose paychecks were once, you know, enough to keep them housed in Salinas, as meager as those paychecks were, and, you know, we should also say as substandard as that housing often was, even that has become out of reach for them. So it really is an example of how this epicenter of housing unaffordability in the Bay Area or in cities like LA or Seattle or New York City are like sort of going further and further out. So the idea that you could simply like pack up and move to a cheaper area nearby is becoming increasingly impossible for these people.
You report that the region's 91,000 farm workers live with stagnant wages. The median pay for farm workers is just over under $13 an hour.
Yeah, and I think something that's often left out of the conversations and debates around the minimum wage, and there's the Fight for 15 campaign, is that when we're talking about wages, we also need to be talking about the housing wage in a particular city. And an organization called the National Low Income Housing Coalition, every year they publish a report where they show for every city in the U.S., here's what you have to make in order to afford a modest, median-priced apartment. And in Salinas, that number is $29.62 an hour. So if the median wage for farm workers is, $12, $13 an hour, you can just see why there is a crisis right now.
Right. So again, to afford a modest two-bedroom, a person must make about $30 an hour, and right now they're making $12 or $13 an hour. You also report that over the past 8 years, there's been a 30% loss of low-rent units in Salinas, while rents have shot up by almost 60% since 2014. This is about four times the national average.
Yeah. And, I think it's tempting to hear those numbers and to see a place like Salinas as a kind of bizarre anomaly, And while those numbers are really dramatic and striking, you can really go to an increasing number of cities around the country where you find, if not those numbers per se, what you find is a similar gap between what people are making and what it costs to remain housed. And that's why, I argue that this homelessness crisis that we're seeing in cities like LA and San Francisco, unfortunately, I believe that unless really drastic action is taken, by every level, by the federal, local, city governments, we're going to see similar epidemics around the country.
Right. And I mean, we're seeing it all over the country. Let's talk about the family that you started your piece with. It's Candido and Brenda's family, and they were one of the thousands of families who've become the victims of this crisis. They landed jobs in the frozen burrito factory at Sweet Earth Foods, and they were getting $15.25 an hour before taxes. And I think you make a great point, because we often hear about the fight for 15. We want a $15 minimum wage, which obviously is so much better than the federal minimum wage right now. But at this point, for so many people, that still would not cover their rent and their utilities.
Yeah, and I think it goes to a question of, what kind of country do we want to live in? What kinds of communities do we want to live in? $15 an hour from a certain perspective might sound like a lot, but when you look at the profits that these companies are bringing in, it's really scandalous that there are people who, in Salinas, it's a particular irony because these are the people who are actually picking the food that we are enjoying across the country every day, and yet those same people are unable, in many cases, to feed their families. And food insecurity is as big of an issue in Salinas right now as housing insecurity. So, I think that when you look at what these companies are making versus what they're paying their employees, it's kind of insane.
Well, and when you're talking about a $15 minimum wage, that's about $31,000 a year, about. And and then you take out taxes, and so it's lower than that. Can you tell us, since you brought up these corporations, I mean, I just looked up Sweet Earth Foods. Again, this is a local vegan and vegetarian burrito company. And according to Crunchbase, they've got about $25 million in revenue annually. And I'm guessing that's probably low when you talk about some of these major agriculture companies.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me in writing this article, like, there's a temptation to find a villain, you know, a big corporate villain. And in this case, I think that as a whole, the agricultural industry in the Salinas Valley does bear a lot of responsibility for what we're seeing. It's not just, you know, the people coming down from Silicon Valley. It's also an industry that has chosen to keep their workers in this kind of precarious state. And you know, one irony that I point out in the article is that the Monterey County Food Bank, the vast majority of the food that they give out every year is actually donated by the same agricultural companies who refuse to pay their workers a livable or even, you know, a housing wage. So I think there's something really bizarre about that. As far as Sweet Earth Foods goes, you know, Brenda and Candida, who work there, they really liked working at the company. And I think, you know, ultimately they, Candida lost his job there because their son suffers from a developmental delay, and he was having to go pick his son up at school more and more frequently. And ultimately his manager just said, you know, why don't you take care of your family issues, and he lost that job. We could debate, you know, the rightness of that decision. It certainly seemed pretty harsh from where I was standing, but I think the point I'm trying to make is just that Sweet Earth Foods is doing what companies in America tend to do, which is pay their employees what they can get away with.
Right. And we're almost out of time, but I want to talk also about just how difficult it is to live in your car. I think now that this is so pervasive in so many cities around California, and we're talking about having these safe parking lots, let's just talk about how difficult this is. As you write, finding a place for the family to park the van was harder than expected. At first, they tried the parking lot at a Food for Less grocery store, but the next morning, an employee warned them not to return because neighborhood gangs control the area and they're threatening homeless people. And then they drove to a nearby strawberry farm, which was more hospitable. They did some chores around the property, like cleaning up bathrooms and emptying trash, and the farm's owner would fill up their gas tank. But then other families showed up, and it became too much, and they were told they should go somewhere else. So then they went to a parking lot at a medical center, but the father was afraid because there was someone else in their truck in the middle of the night. I mean, can you just tell us how hard this is for these families?
Yeah, and this was something that I didn't really appreciate, I think, until I was actually there with the family. As it's getting dark, they're getting ready to go to sleep. I'm getting ready to say goodbye to them. And, you know, the tight space of the van, all of their possessions crammed into it, the fear of just what lays outside of their van every night, the difficulty in getting sleep and what the lack of sleep night after night does to a family, the fears that, you know, most kids have just in any circumstance, you know, in any kind of living situation, but these fears that are amplified by living in this space and having strangers approaching the van at various hours. I mean, it really just, when I met them, they had been in the van for almost a year, and I think they would agree that their state, you know, emotionally, physically, psychologically had just begun to sort of deteriorate. And that was, I think I felt that and saw that on a really visceral level, that kind of gets lost, I think, in just talking in the abstract about homeless families or safe parking lots and this sort of thing.
Mm. And Brian, before we end, we're not talking about a poor state here. This is the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. Have you heard from any politicians in response to your article?
No, I haven't. I mean, I know that a couple of politicians throughout the state, I believe in Southern California, have shared the article on social media, which I was happy to see. I mean, you know, to be fair, in California there is this kind of flurry of reporting on homelessness, so this certainly isn't the first article to address this issue. But I would absolutely love for more journalism to be done. You know, again, that kind of goes beyond the official story, and that really gets into the experience of especially families and the toll that that begins to take. So, but yeah, I would definitely welcome the opportunity to speak with any political leader about this issue.
And in your reporting in our final minute, what solutions came up in the interviews you did?
I mean, on the family homelessness side of things, a really clear solution would be to expand the definition, the federal definition of who counts as homeless, according to HUD. Because right now, families who are living doubled up with relatives living in motels, sort of cycling between these different locations, they're locked out of assistance. They're not counted as homeless, as I said earlier. And expanding that definition would be a huge step toward, you know, at least recognizing the scale of this problem. And then on the housing side of things, you know, there's reforming the exclusionary zoning that is sort of endemic to a state like California that doesn't allow high-density, low-income housing to be built in many communities. Rent control is something that that seems very feasible as a way of sort of halting this emergency. And, you know, and just increasing the number of housing units. Oh, and finally, paying workers more.
Right.
paying them what they deserve to be making and where their labor is actually valued.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Brian. Brian Goldstone wrote a piece for the California Sunday Magazine, 3 Kids, 2 Paychecks, No Home. You can find the piece at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.